So 1st and 2nd Chronicles written as a single book to begin with, but where it was decided to break it, it ends with the reign of David. And so we begin the Solomon portion of the story in the first nine chapters of 2nd Chronicles here. And although Solomon is not David, they really, their stories go together. It's in a lot of ways the same story. It's the glory of the Davidic kingdom, the Davidic era of the time of both David and Solomon. Solomon's just kind of the fulfillment of the Davidic vision. God had made the promise to David, and even in making that promise, it was obvious that the fulfillment of that promise would not be until Solomon. Now, we look back and say, well, the fulfillment really isn't until Jesus, and in some ways until the final day of judgment. But that's the thinking of the writer here, that it all hinges on what we are learning about the David-Solomon story, and that as great as that was, even they are not able to attain to the kind of greatness and glory that God has in mind that Jesus will usher in as the Messiah. But the basic points that are being made here, again, instead of focusing on their failures and shortcomings, as we've noted time and again, that the writer of Chronicles kind of, you know, he doesn't ignore them, but he's not emphasizing them or you know, calling attention to them. You know, it's the promise that God has made. It is a king like David, or on the model of David. And that is to say, when David was at his best and modeled a person who walked in the statutes of God and so on, and so also with Solomon. And also the role of the temple in all of this, that Solomon builds the temple, it represents God's presence with the people. And the whole temple theme really permeates the David-Solomon story throughout. And so it is even here. And so we've now had the temple built, and it's been dedicated in chapter 6. And in chapter 7, God visits Solomon a second time. The writer of Kings makes that point, that Yahweh appeared to Solomon a second time. And this is some, you know, 20 years or so apart from one another. And so it's not like, you know, Solomon was getting regular visits from, you know, God on a weekly basis or something like that. And it's significant, you know, if God goes to all this trouble to appear to you, you think, well, that's important, you know, write that down. Yeah, it's a red letter day. And so he asked for wisdom, and Solomon's reign has been characterized by the wisdom that God had given to him. And as a corollary to that, all the riches and fame and everything else that went with that. The second visit was to say, okay, I have chosen this place, you know, not just the land of Israel and the city of Jerusalem, but this location on Mount Moriah where the temple is built. This is where my name will dwell in a special way that shows my presence with my people. And so, when my people sin, I will hear their prayer, and so on. But there's a condition, just like there was with the Davidic promise. If the king sins, God will chastise him. But the kingdom would not be taken away like it was from Saul. There would not be a permanent end to the kingdom of David, even if it was chastised severely. And here the condition is, if you will follow in the footsteps of your father David and keep my commandments, then your throne will be established. That's in verse 18. I will establish your royal throne as I covenanted with your father David, saying you shall not lack a man to be ruler in Israel. And that clearly suggests that you could go through a time period where there is no king sitting on the throne. That doesn't mean the line has been cut off forever like it was from Saul, but you are without a king, and that's exactly what's going to happen. Now, they probably wouldn't have read it that way because that's not their expectation, or that's not the context in which they're going to hear that statement. But with hindsight, it becomes a very telling condition that there may be times where there lacks a man to set as ruler in Israel. And not only that, but if you turn away and forsake the covenant, I will uproot you from the land, in verse 20, and this house, which I have consecrated for my name, I will cast out of my sight and make it a proverb and a byword among the peoples. And so it's going to be a heap of ruins, and people will say, well, what happened? It was such a beautiful temple. And, of course, the most natural conclusion that a typical pagan would make in the ancient world is, well, that God of Israel, he wasn't much of a god. You know, maybe he knew a couple of card tricks, but anything really important, he couldn't keep his people from being carried off into captivity or his own temple from being destroyed. And so before that happens, God has already built into the thinking of the people, now whether they stop and think about it, but all the way back to Moses, God had put the condition of the keeping of the covenant as one of the conditions of staying in the land. And now he's articulated that is also true of the temple, continuing to have this temple. And what we emphasized last week was, just as the Feast of Tabernacles was a memorial feast to recall the time they didn't have a permanent place to live, but now they do, and God has kept that part of the promise in bringing them to a land of milk and honey and giving them permanence in the land. And that's now symbolized further by giving them the kingdom of David, and then symbolized even further by giving them this permanent temple to represent that permanence of God with them in this land. But it's not as permanent as you think it is, because it depends upon being faithful and keeping the covenant of God. Now, that being said, God never says, I will reject you as my people, period. You know, I will no longer keep the promise to Abraham or the promise to David. That's the very thing God says he won't do. But you will be chastised and it will be great suffering. And so what I'm suggesting is, even after hundreds of years, it helps to explain why at least some Jews figured out, no, God's still going to keep his promise. You know, Messiah is still going to come. And so when Jesus came, there were lots of Jews who were fully expecting the Messiah was going to show up any day. Now, they were expecting a different kind of Messiah. We understand that, but they had not given up hope. Now, we don't know how many Jews might have given up hope over the years. There's probably some. Oh, this is stupid. You know, how long is, you know, mom and dad and grandpa and grandma going to keep believing this nonsense? We're no different than any other nations of the earth, except we're much smaller and weaker and, you know, pathetic. And, you know, let's get with the program. So, but we know where all of this is headed because we have some hindsight to this. And so now this is the conclusion of the David-Solomon story. And then that will begin leading into the crisis period, which is, well, wait a minute, now the kingdom's divided. What does that mean? And, of course, the people that are reading this story have come back after the exile. They know all this information. And it's really going to be, again, a message in, there have been many crises in the history of Israel, and every one of them is because of the faithlessness of the people. But what you see when you cut through all of the suffering and all of the superficial symptoms of the matter, God is still keeping his promise, and God is still not giving up on his people, and you just need to hold to the faith and believe that God is still going to keep that promise in its ultimate sense here. All right, Kevin.
Would you say that that's the primary, I guess, the primary thing that's on the mind of, like, the biblical writers when they say, well, you know, Lord, you know, don't destroy these people for your name's sake, or, you know, keep this thing for your name's sake, that it is primarily because they know how other nations will be looking at this God, and it's like, it's almost as if it's a defense of his own character if he doesn't fall through this thing.
Well, that's pretty clear in many cases that, you know, this is what the nations will say, and you know, at least from a human point of view, that doesn't seem like a good thing. And again, it all gets back to how you think of God. You know, did God not know this, you know? And Moses has to say, now, God, think about this. You know, what are the Egyptians going to say? Oh, well, oh, thanks, Moses. I'm about to do something stupid there, you know. So that's clearly not what's happening. And it becomes more the reason God does this is to give an opening for someone like Moses or Aaron. And we've been seeing this recently in the Numbers class with Nathan. For them to step up and say, you know, Lord, I beg you not to do this, to be merciful. You know, we know that's your fundamental character in all of this. And it is extraordinary when you stop and think about it because hypothetically the alternative is, oh, Lord, don't do this because you realize what kind of trouble this is going to cause me? You know what's going to happen to my 401k or, you know, any number of other things because of how it impacts us. But that's not the plea of the righteous. They pray for the sake of God and His character and His glory. And so it gives them a chance to kind of reemphasize that. And through the Holy Spirit recording this to reemphasize, that needs to be our attitude as well. I mean, the last thing I would want to happen is for the United States just to fall into chaos and society disintegrate and the economy collapse and so on. And I couldn't help but think, what will happen to me, my livelihood? What's going to happen to the college? What's going to happen to my kids and my grandkids and them taking care of their families and all that? But ultimately, you know, it's whatever judgment God chooses to bring against our nation is utterly deserved. And if that is His will, then so be it. You know, if I'm going to cry out to God, you know, it needs to be more on the basis of some spiritual thing rather than just my own personal petty, you know, financial or material interests. You know, I'm not saying we need to make light of, you know, whether we're where our next meal's coming from or something like that. But it's especially in moments like that we have to reemphasize what Paul says in Philippians chapter 4. We get to learn in whatever circumstance we find ourselves to be content. You know, it's not like if I find myself homeless that God doesn't know, you know. And, you know, Gabriel needs to go knock on the door of heaven. God, did you realize Tom's homeless? He's one of the faithful ones, you know, right? We got to do something about this, right? No. And it's really my responsibility to be content with whatever, you know, lot that comes my way in life. So, but that's certainly a great concern on the minds of a lot of those people. So, well, let's turn our attention to chapters 8 and 9. And the first 16 verses are, it's really a struggle to know exactly where to put them in an outline. And so I think I've done it a couple of ways. You can make it, if we go back to the, well, got to hit the right button here. On this outline here, building the temple runs from chapter 2, verse 1 through chapter 8, verse 16. But the temple's already built by the time we get to chapter 6, and the temple's dedicated. And then chapter 7, again, is some 20 years later, but the focus is still on the temple and the role of the temple. What's going to happen to the temple if the people are not faithful? It's God's response to the prayer of Solomon in chapter 6. And even though it's separated by some years of time, you know, the writer just chooses to leave out all those intervening things that happen in Solomon's reign and gets to the point, which is Solomon did build the temple. And then God told Solomon, it's just going to be a pile of rocks if you're not faithful and, you know, so on. So there's the condition. And so you could say, well, at the end of chapter 7, that should be the end of the temple part of this, because chapters 8 and 9 seem to be a lot about Solomon's, you know, it's a short section compared to the temple building section, and it focuses on Solomon's wealth and wisdom and, you know, how great things are in the reign of Solomon. And also sounds very much like where the story started, back in chapter 1, which also was emphasizing the greatness of Solomon and how much money he had, and particularly that he made a lot of it by trade, and particularly in horses and that kind of thing. And that gets reemphasized here in this latter section. So that's why we've outlined it this way: the greatness of Solomon at the beginning, the greatness of Solomon at the end. And I think the clear implication is it is his faithfulness in building the temple, and not just building the structure, but arranging the priestly order and the worship services and all of that, that God has blessed him. And so a corollary lesson is that if you will worship God and keep your focus on him and all that is in order, then, you know, everything else is going to fall into place. A New Testament version of this would be, you know, don't worry about what you're going to eat, what you're going to wear. You know, seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. So that's really the lesson here. And Solomon has sought the kingdom of God first, and all these other things are added to him. But notice in verse 16, you know, you got all this other stuff that's happening in these first 16 verses. But verse 16 says, thus all the work of Solomon was carried out from the day of the foundation of the house of Yahweh until it was finished. And so the house of Yahweh was completed. And so at least from a literary perspective, this is where the writer's thinking still is with the completion of the temple, right? And so that's why I suggest even keeping these 16 verses of chapter 8 in connection with the section on building the temple in chapters 2 through 7. So, again, you can argue it either way, but given verse 16 is still harping on the building of the temple and its completion, you could say that's the theme that ties all that together. And so the point being, as I just articulated a moment ago, Solomon's success is really emphasized as being a consequence of Solomon's dedication to the things of God as illustrated in his role in building the temple and that kind of thing. So so it's something of an appendix, I guess you could say. So... you know, God's the foundation of everything. And so whatever security people experience under Solomon's rule, whatever blessing or prosperity, the fact they don't lack anything, all that is really emphasizing the foundation, which is God himself. And again, the takeaway lesson for the people who were reading this after they came back out of exile, and they're just a very small country, and they're not very prosperous, and they seem to be lacking lots of things. They don't seem to be a very blessed people. Well, what do we need? Well, you need to keep God as your foundation and be faithful, and all that other will sort itself out. And the same thing's true for us today. Keep God as the foundation. Put him first. And so it is still yet again a foreshadowing of the messianic rule that will come with Jesus here. So just looking at some of the details here, came about at the end of the 20 years in which Solomon had built the house of Yahweh and his own house. He built the cities which Huram, or Hiram, had given to him. There's two different spellings of his name. And settled the sons of Israel there. Solomon went to Hamath-Zobah and captured it. He built Tadmor in the wilderness and all the storage cities which he had built in Hamath. He also built upper Beth Horon and lower Beth Horon, fortified cities with walls, gates, and bars, Baalath and all the storage cities. Solomon had all the cities for his chariots and cities for his horsemen, and all that it pleased Solomon to build in Jerusalem and Lebanon and in all the land under his rule. So the point you get from all this is just how extensive the boundaries of Solomon's kingdom are. And one of the reasons that's significant is because you remember in the promise to Abraham, God had stated that all this land will be yours, you know, from this boundary to this boundary and from this boundary to this boundary. And it's only under the reign of Solomon that that promised boundary that would be given to Abraham and his descendants was achieved. And so that's, again, one of the significant markers of the greatness of the David-Solomon story is God fulfilled his promise that they would occupy this territory. Again, these people that are coming back from exile, their kingdom was reduced in size. It was like, you know, from that wall to that wall, you know, and very tiny compared to what it had been in Solomon's day. So again, has God forgotten us? Is this the end? Is this just the final death throes of the nation before we go the way of the dodo bird, so to speak? I mean, that's a metaphor for us, not them. Dodos were thriving in their day, apparently. You know, that's what happens to kingdoms. And that's what's really remarkable when you think about this from a biblical perspective, because, you know, where are the Babylonians today? Well, they no longer exist, right? And the Assyrians, you know, and those were two of the great superpowers of the ancient world. They don't even exist anymore. And all the neighbors of the Israelites, the Arameans, the Philistines, the Moabites, the Ammonites, and on it goes. They're all gone, right? And yet, you know, the descendants of Abraham still keep plugging along. Why is that? Well, it could just be a quirk of history. Certainly if you had lived at the time, you would have thought, oh, we're doomed. We're nothing. We're small and insignificant. And all these powerful neighbors that we have that are causing us so much trouble. Well, again, you blink your eye and they're gone. And that's a testimony again to God's judgment on them. When judgment came against them, it resulted in their annihilation ultimately. But that was not the case with God's people. Now, that's not a comment about whether, you know, the modern state of Israel is, you know, the people of God or anything like that. I think we have to take seriously what the New Testament says about who the people of God are. You know, it's the same point that's made about Jesus being the Messiah. Well, he's clearly not a king in the same sense, you know, Josiah or Hezekiah or David were king. He's a greater king, and he's a king over a spiritual kingdom. And so that's something of significance as well. So here we have the great territory that Solomon rules over. And there are still some of these Hittites and Amorites and Perizzites and Hivites and Jebusites that are not of Israel. And what Solomon does with them is put them to work, forced labor, a kind of slavery, but, you know, they had a special word for it. So we didn't think of them as slaves in the literal sense that we might. But he did not make slaves for his work of the sons of Israel. They were men of war, chief captains, commanders of his chariots and his horsemen. And these were the chief officers of King Solomon, 250 who ruled over the people, right? And so, again, there's a distinction made between those who are put to this forced labor and, you know, how Solomon treated the, you know, the native people, I guess you might say, of Israel. Verse 11 is interesting because now we have a acknowledgement of how Solomon married Pharaoh's daughter. And these were probably, I mean, 99% sure, these are political alliances that are made. And so it's a rather extraordinary statement that this rabble band that left Egypt in the Exodus under Moses has now attained to such political significance that a marriage is arranged between Solomon and the daughter of Pharaoh. And he brought her up from the city of David to the house which he had built for her, for he said, "My wife shall not dwell in the house of David, king of Israel, because the places are holy where the ark of Yahweh has entered." So this is a little detail that we're not given in Samuel and Kings, that at least in this regard, he was fastidious about where, you know, she would live along with her retinue of, you know, priests of her, you know, political and religious persuasion. Now, of course, the way Samuel and Kings tells the story about David's marriage with Pharaoh's daughter is what? What's the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey would say? What? Beginning of the fall, you know, his wives proved to be his undoing. Because they were pagans, and they all had their pagan deities that they still worshipped and so on. I mean, it wouldn't have been an issue if, you know, like Ruth the Moabitess, she converted, you know, or Rahab the, you know, prostitute from Jericho, who was a Canaanite and a pagan and a Gentile. So it's not this, it's not a racial or, you know, national kind of thing, an ethnic cleansing or anything like that. It has to do with their, you know, whether they're serving idols or not. And so for those who were willing to turn to the one true God, they were welcomed with open arms and accepted into Israel. And that's a foreshadowing, of course, of how those that would turn away, you know, that the ultimate kingdom of God is open to all, Jew and Gentile, in Jesus Christ. But you'll notice again, the chronicler doesn't make a big emphasis about Solomon's unfaithful wives and leading him to unfaithfulness, but rather emphasizes that, at least in this regard, he was, you know, recognizing her unholy status or defiling status, and so I wanted her to live in a, you know, separate place here. And so again, it's part of his wanting to emphasize the more faithful side of Solomon as opposed to his failures. So then Solomon offered burnt offerings to Yahweh on the altar of Yahweh, which he had built before the porch. So this is outside of the temple sanctuary building in front. And there he's offering sacrifices. Did so according to the daily rule, offering them up according to the commandment of Moses for the Sabbaths, the new moons, the three annual feasts, the Feast of Unleavened Bread, or Passover, the Feast of Weeks, which came to be known as Pentecost, and the Feast of Booths, or Tabernacles. So, of course, there was the morning and evening sacrifice every day, and then special sacrifices on these other special occasions. So Solomon's faithful about that. And verse 14, according to the ordinance of his father David, he appointed the divisions of the priests for their service, the Levites for their duties of praise and ministering before the priest according to the daily rule, the gatekeepers by their divisions at every gate, and those were also Levites. For David, the man of God, had so commanded, and it wasn't that David just came up with this on his own, this was by the direction of the Holy Spirit, through a couple of the prophets that were sent to him. And they did not depart from the commandment of the king that was made to the priests and the Levites in any manner or concerning the storehouses. And so thus all the work was accomplished. And so it seems as if the faithful worship of Solomon and the ordering of the priests and the Levites and all of that, and seeing over a period of time how all that was working well, is part of the picture of the building and the establishment of the temple and getting into a routine and everything's going the way it needs to be going. And so that's why, again, this is something of an appendix to the building of the temple proper story. And it illustrates now the success that Solomon is having in connection with having built the temple and continuing to worship there faithfully and things like that. Now, the next section is going to be taken up with other indicators of the success of Solomon. Again, in terms of his worship again, which we've seen a little bit of that already, his wealth and his wisdom, and how all that's going to come together. But anything in the first 16 verses of chapter 8 or anything we've talked about that's prompted any thoughts or questions? Andrew?
I do think it's interesting how the description of his and David's success differ. David's is always about the conquered this people and he was successful in this war, and you have that description of God saying you're a man with blood on his hands, a man of war. And when you have Solomon, there's a little bit of it, like he took this one city, but it's more of he subjugated these people, and these people were under his rule. It just skips over how he ever accomplished that, or how that ever happened. It does not describe him as a man of war. I don't know whether or not he actually did go to war against these people to subjugate them, or whatever he did, but the Bible does not state that. I just thought that was a very interesting thing that seems to matter to God in describing
Yeah, and that is something we talked about way back when, you know, the reason God gave to David why he couldn't build the temple, but his son would do so, was you're this man of blood, right? And there are a couple of ways you could read that, one being that well, that's somehow morally reprehensible and therefore you've disqualified yourself. You know, it's something you shouldn't have been doing, and this is the penalty you're going to pay for that. Which is difficult because, you know, God's the one that told David to go wage all these wars and seemed to do so faithfully for the most part. I think obviously in the case of Uriah, you know, that particular battle was a nefarious and evil thing that David did. But, and then Solomon had, you know, a little bit of military waging going on too. But in terms of the focus, you know, David's rule was characterized by battle. And so things were not settled. They didn't have the rest that God had promised that would come about at the end of David's reign and be characteristic of the reign of Solomon, whose very name means peace or rest. And so what you find is a transition of governmental figures where throughout the time of David, it's always the captains of hundreds and thousands and so on. It's a military kind of structure. And under Solomon, it becomes a much more, civilian kind of makeup, right? Now, we read verse 9 here a moment ago, which still speaks of the men of war, chief captains, commanders of the chariots and horsemen. And of course, it's not that Solomon didn't have an army at all, but the primary framework and structure of the government was a more peacetime, kind of status. And that was what God had said it was to be. And so we suggested that, you know, whereas David was allowed to do a lot of planning and investing and gathering of materials for the building of the temple, the time was not right, the setting was not right until the period of rest had been attained. And with the coming of Solomon and that rest, now is the time for the building of the temple. So partly it may have been God's, you know, symbolism or what message he was intending to convey by the way he was going about doing, you know, this kind of thing. So again, just mention that as a possibility. Wouldn't, you know, kick anyone out of church for, you know, disagreeing with me about that. Something to think about. So here we have three basic parts of this next section. Seemed to me a pretty bad chapter division. We could have ended the chapter with verse 16, and then verses 17 and 18 speak of these ships that engage in trade. So Solomon went to Ezion-Geber, and if we put a map up here, you know, if you picture the Mount Sinai Peninsula that kind of sticks down as a wedge of land. And so you got the Red Sea and the Gulf of Suez on the west side, and then Aqaba on the right-hand side. And Ezion-Geber is right there at the peak of that water. And in the time of Solomon, the land that Solomon controlled reached down to that point on the Gulf. And and obviously you need a port city for this. Now you could have had a port city on the Mediterranean, but that limits where those ships go, obviously. If you start at Ezion-Geber, then you can go to Africa and India and places like that. So, and to Eloth on the seashore in the land of Edom, and Hiram, or Huram, again, by his servants, sent him ships and servants who knew the sea. And, of course, the Phoenicians were probably the most accomplished seafaring people in the ancient world that we're aware of. And so since they knew a lot about that, he gave them ships and people to sail them. And again, did they sail those all the way around Africa to take them to Ezengeber, or did they transport these over land, something? They went with Solomon's servants to Ophir and took from there 450 talents of gold and brought them to King Solomon. So, you know, it's just a very short little description of these trading ships. But how significant are they? Well, look, when we get into chapter 9 and verse 10, they come up again. The servants of Hiram and the servants of Solomon who brought gold from Ophir also brought algum trees and precious stones. And from the algum trees, and no one knows exactly what tree that is, the king made steps for the house of Yahweh and for the king's palace and lyres and harps for the singers, and none like that was seen before in the land of Judah. These are exotic things that are being brought from who knows where in far-flung places, and they come by these trading ships again, right? And then come on down to verse 21, the last reference we had in verse 20, all King Solomon's drinking vessels were of gold. All the vessels of the house of the forest of Lebanon were pure gold. Silver was not considered valuable in the days of Solomon. You know, it's kind of like how many people anymore see a penny on the ground and stop and pick it up? It's like, oh, it's a penny, you know. And I don't know, who knows now? It's a $10 bill. That's not worth it either. More political inflationary comment. Okay. You know, then there's people who actually been over and pick up a penny because, you know, that's money, right? But, so, you know, silver is just considered of no real value at all because it's, you know, gold is so common, I guess you might say. And then, so you notice the connection then. So that brings up verse 21. For the king had ships which went to Tarshish with the servants of Hiram. Once every 3 years, the ships of Tarshish came bringing gold and silver, ivory and apes and peacocks. And you're like, well, of course, no one's sure what these peacocks are. Do you translate it peacock? Some Bibles will say another kind of, you know, monkey. A baboon, yeah. So if you're wondering, you know, like, I know the difference between a peacock and a baboon, right? Well, yeah, but this Hebrew word and what's intended to convey. But if it is baboons and apes, I mean, where are you going to get those? You know, you don't get those in Spain. You get those from Africa, obviously. In the ships of Tarshish, some would argue that it doesn't actually say that they're sailing to Tarshish, because Tarshish, we know, is a reference to the far western reaches of the Mediterranean. So Spain would certainly be kind of the limits of Tarshish over there. Sometimes people would use it of something a little closer, like probably Italy would be considered far enough west to qualify as well. So it doesn't have to have a very exact meaning to it. But some have argued that these being ships of Tarshish didn't mean they actually were sailing to Tarshish, but they were just seaworthy enough for a long voyage like that. And so that's obviously what you need if you're sailing to India or Africa from Ezengeber. But it just must mean pretty something for them for the writer to mention so many times these ships that are sailing out there and bringing back gold and other kind of exotic treasures. But that's an indication, again, of the power that Solomon has over all these trade routes and the great wealth that he has and so on, right? The second of these is the famous Queen of Sheba story, which occupies the first 12 verses here. Most people know the story of the Queen of Sheba. She heard of the wisdom of Solomon, had to come check it out for herself. He answers all of her questions, and she's just astounded more than she would have expected. You know, the half hasn't been told. You know, so verse 5, It was a true report which I heard in my own land about your words and your wisdom. Nevertheless, I did not believe their reports until I came, and my eyes had seen it. And behold, half of the greatness of your wisdom was not told me. You surpassed the report that I heard. How blessed are your men, how blessed are these your servants who stand before you continually and hear your wisdom. Blessed be Yahweh your God, who delighted in you, setting you on his throne as king for Yahweh your God. Because your God loved Israel, establishing them forever, and therefore he made you king over them to do justice and righteousness. I mean, this queen's understanding of the role of the king of Israel is a much better understanding than most of the kings of Israel had, right? It's kind of extraordinary. And of course, it's preserved by the writer to emphasize even people outside of the nation could have and should have had this basic understanding of what the king was all about. And she gave Solomon 120 talents of gold, a very great amount of spices and precious stones. There had never been spice like that which the queen of Sheba gave to King Solomon. And of course, the word Sheba just means south. Yemen, if you know where the nation of Yemen is, on the southern extremities of the Arabian Peninsula, that's another word that means south. And so most scholars think that's the area that the Queen of Sheba came from. And so she traversed the length of the Arabian Peninsula to come to Jerusalem and see Solomon. But then out of all this vast treasure she gave to Solomon, notice verse 12, King Solomon gave to the Queen of Sheba all her desire which she requested, besides a return for what she had brought to the king. So he gave her enough presents in return to make up for what she had given him, and then more so. So she wasn't out anything on this trip, right? So it's kind of like, you know, exchanging Christmas gifts, and, you know, she gave him a $5 gift card, and he gave her a $100 gift card, you know. And she turned and went to her own land with her servants, right? And then the enormous wealth of Solomon is detailed in verses 13 through 28. You know, the weight of gold which came to Solomon in 1 year was 666 talents of gold, besides that which the traders and merchants brought. And all the kings of Arabia and the governors of the country brought gold and silver to Solomon. And so the couple things that are mentioned here is we have these 200 large shields of beaten gold, and each of these shields has 600 shekels of gold used in them. And then there's 300... smaller shields that have 300 shekels of gold in each of them, and the king installed these shields in the house of the forest of Lebanon. So the royal palace complex was made up of like four different parts, and one of these parts was called the house of the forest of Lebanon, presumably because so much cedar was used in it, you know, you're living in the middle of the Lebanon forest. And just to give you some idea about what these shields are, in modern buying power, you're talking about $42 million for the big shields and $31.5 million for the smaller shields. So that's over $70 million you're just spending on decorative, you know, displays in your palace. That's an extraordinary amount of wealth. And then you remember what happened to the golden shields? The Pharaoh came in, Shishak came in and carted them off because of Solomon's unfaithfulness. And so they were replaced with bronze shields instead. And you can read through the rest of that, all the great treasures that he had. And again, verse 26, he was ruler over all the kings from the Euphrates River to the land of the Philistines to the border of Egypt. Silver was as common as rocks. Cedars were as plentiful as sycamore trees, and they were bringing horses from all over. And then finally it ends with the death of Solomon, just the last few verses. Again, of all the things Solomon did and you could have talked about, and particularly his unfaithfulness and all of his wives and his idolatry and, you know, kind of an ignoble end to his rule. Instead, the writer just says, you want to know more about Solomon? You can read about it in the records of Nathan the prophet, the prophecy of Ahijah the Shilonite, which that has some bearing on the prophecy that was made to Jeroboam and the split of the kingdom. And the visions of Iddo the seer concerning Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, and Solomon reigned 40 years in Jerusalem over all Israel. Solomon slept with his fathers, was buried in the city of his father David, and his son Rehoboam reigned in his place. So that then sets us up for the reign of Rehoboam and the split of the kingdom in the next chapter and so on. So we'll have to leave it there for now, and we'll come back on Christmas and talk about the split of the kingdom. So.